Lawrence Lehmer is a best-selling author and journalist. He is an international fellow at Columbia University and is the most recent author of Mar-a-Lago: Inside the Gates of Power. This is Lawrence Lehmer. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I am here with Lawrence Lehmer. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
I'm glad to be here.
So I wanted to talk to you because you had written a book about Mar-a-Lago, Trump's golf course and a place where he spends a lot of his time, obviously. First off, how did you get involved writing this book? I mean, why did this subject interest you?
Well, I've lived in Palm Beach in the winter, just in the winter, for 25 years. It's the strangest place I've ever seen in my life. It's really bizarre. You come here, you don't see people on the street, you just... Everything is inside. Everything is hidden away. And I had this idea that I'd come here and I'd write a book about it. Well, it took me a long, long time to do that. I finally wrote a book, Madness Under the Royal Palms, which was so controversial that you'd see people reading it with another book jacket on it, so controversial that the Palm Beach Daily News, the local newspaper, has banned me from ever being mentioned in its pages for life. So that was enough about writing. Yeah, so that was enough of writing about Palm Beach. But then when Trump, you know, I wasn't a member of Mar-a-Lago, but I went there. I had many friends over there. And I'd go there all the time. I'd see Trump. I'd talk to Trump sometime. And when he got elected, I've been here from the time the club that turned into a club. When he turned into a club, I know so many people. I thought it was crucial part of his life and the making of this man was his relationship to Mar-a-Lago, and so I decided to write a book about it.
I agree from having written read your book that it definitely there's a lot of patterns in his life down there that have manifested over the course of his presidency, beginning with this long-standing pattern where he simultaneously really wants to be accepted by the establishment, but also holding huge resentment for the fact that they're so disgusted with him. Could you talk a little bit about how the Palm Beach reacted when he first came to town?
Well, Palm Beach is a very staid, WASP community, and where people come on this island, and if they want to get into the exclusive, restricted clubs, they become somebody else. They don't say anything controversial. Don't want to get anything that'll get them blackballed. So that's the persona of this place. And you go to these parties and people don't say anything. It's incredibly boring. That's what it means to be a success. I mean, it's a strange thing, but that's the way these people behave. Trump comes down here bombastically. He's his own, I mean, give him credit. He was his own man. He wasn't going to do what they wanted to do. When he was getting a divorce, he had a party with these hundreds of models from Miami. He was flamboyantly flaunting himself and his life. And Palm Beach had never seen anything like this. And he frankly didn't give a damn.
And you mentioned, though, that he learned a lot of his techniques that he used to win the presidency during his fights with this establishment in Palm Beach. Could you elaborate on that part a little bit?
Well, this community, with this very conservative community, didn't like him and did everything to stop him from getting everything he wanted in this club, in this estate that he bought when he wanted to turn it into a club. And he just didn't back off. He got more and more belligerent. He attacked them. He stood up to them, accused them of anti-Semitism. He just made these terrible charges against them. They weren't true, but he made them. But it scared the heck out of these people, and that's how he got his way. And so he learned never to back off, never to back up. That's him. Never to say you're sorry. Never to say you made a mistake. Never to say you made a lie.
Yeah, I remember reading a famous poker player describing politicians and how there's different types of poker players, and one of them is a jackal, and someone who just goes all in every time. And he seems to really resemble that based off your description. But when you mentioned the charges of anti-Semitism, he did desegregate the property, didn't he? Like, they didn't allow Jewish people to come on.
Yes, he did. And I think it's probably the best thing he ever did in his life. But mind you, he didn't do it because he was a social activist. He did it as a way to make money. Because there's such a core of anti-Semitism on this island, which thankfully now is kind of slowly isn't as bad as it was before, but so he started this club, and that was a good thing, that suddenly these wealthy Jewish residents had a club they could go to, and this is, again, nobody ever says this, but the club is overwhelmingly Jewish. Nobody wants to say that, but that's the reality. But later, when he wanted to build a bar and he wanted to do these other things, he said he wasn't being allowed because of anti-Semitism, and it had nothing to do with that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The Mar-a-Lago, after he turns it into a club, it becomes sort of a vehicle for publicity for him. How did he use this club to get his name out there?
Well, initially, he said he didn't think he'd be at this club hardly at all. I mean, he was turning into a club and he'd go elsewhere. But he loves adulation. He loves to be in his paper. People are constantly stroking him. And that's what it is. That's what it is today. When he comes in, you know, people stand up and cheer him. They tell him he's great, whatever. He needs that. It's like a disease with him. And it creates problems with his presidency. But he's a genius at publicity. He really is. He can get publicity that nobody else can get. And he understands that there's no such thing as bad publicity. Just get your name out. It doesn't matter what they say as long as they're saying it.
You had written in your book that a day without publicity for him was like a day without sunshine.
Yeah, and he lives in eternal sunshine.
Yes, definitely. Why do you think publicity is so important to him?
Because it's the new power. It's the way publicity, you can cash that in for money. He's a greedy man. He's trying to make as much money as he can. Publicity is your capital.
Right. That's and definitely he's cashed in as much as he possibly can. You know, he's
right. He's never he's the most famous person in the history of the world. Okay, because social media and television and iPhones and stuff are everywhere. So people know him in the way they never knew anybody in human history. That's what this guy has pulled off, and that's what he wants. He wants to be more famous than anybody. He's obsessed with that.
Do you think that's what he wants? On a deeper level, I had heard you mention at one point that he gave you an interesting insight into Citizen Kane and the isolation of, you know, powerful, wealthy people. Could you talk a little bit about that? It seemed like he was
what he doesn't understand. He's incapable of understanding. First of all, he can't stand to be alone. He's always got to have people around him. And Mar-a-Lago is paradise for him because he's constantly adored. He's constantly celebrated. But he is alone. There's no one with him. He doesn't trust anybody ultimately. He has no true friends. He is the most alone person you'll ever see. And that's his egotism. But he is alone. And he makes it, in this fascination of his, and I don't see why people are debating whether we call it assassination. I mean, it's an assassination. It could be justified, but it's an assassination. And how does he make that? He's down in Mar-a-Lago. He's playing golf. He's got the people constantly around him. His residence is just up a quarter from the dining room. People are walking around. People are constantly around. Presidents don't do this. President Kennedy had a family home in Palm Beach, but what would he do? He'd maybe sun himself with a pool. He'd read a book. He'd be with a few buddies. He'd go down to have the church. He'd go to church with three or four Secret Service people. President Nixon at Key Biscayne had a home. He liked to go fishing. President Truman liked to go to at Key West. He had a little house there of his own. He was president. Would they want to have all these people around them? Would any real world leader who has to make these rational, shattering decisions, these difficult decisions, and so presidents have to make, they wouldn't tolerate it for a day. But he not only tolerates it, he needs it. And so he makes that decision. If he'd been in the Oval Office, would he have decided to go ahead? I don't think so. I don't think he would have gone to him, but that's him. And just one other point on that. When President Kennedy, in 62 in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Russians secretly put these nuclear weapons in Cuba, and we were very close to World War II, for 2 weeks, the National Security Council met with Kennedy. And we know about this because it was all taped. The whole thing was taped.
Yeah, the tapes have come out.
Yeah, and first time I listened to them, I thought, what's wrong with this man? He's not saying anything. Kennedy's not saying anything, okay? And then I realized that, he's got to make the decision. He's not saying anything because he has to make a decision. Everybody in that room, like 20 people, they all wanted to either invade Cuba or to bomb it, okay? Kennedy was the only one who was reluctant and wasn't sure. And he holds back and holds back. And finally, after many days, he realizes, because of his vast knowledge of international affairs, that we have these nuclear missiles that are in Turkey facing Russia. And the Russians are really upset by this. And these Russians and these missiles of ours are redundant. We have Polaris submarines. We don't need those missiles anymore. So he says, hey, why don't we just go to the Russians and say, we'll take our missiles off here if you'll take your missiles away from Cuba. And that's what happened, okay? Now, years later, we learned that there were tactical nuclear weapons on the beach in Cuba. They were sitting there. If we had bombed or if we had invaded, almost certainly, they would have set those nuclear weapons off, and we would have had World War III. We might not need to be here today. Now, put Truman, put Trump in that scenario. Put him in that room. Would he sit there for two weeks?
Terrible.
Would he thoughtfully listen? He'd make that decision in 15 minutes. That's the kind of president we have.
Right. No, I mean, you're absolutely right about the Cuban Missile Crisis, where, I mean, listening to those tapes, it's crazy just how everyone else in that room was so eager to go to war. But the one thing that made me, you know, just this kind of an aside, but on Kennedy, hadn't the Russians sent because I know you've also written about the Kennedys before, hadn't the Russians also sent a wire to Kennedy about the exchange of missiles in Turkey for for removing missiles from Cuba, but he had initially sort of shelved the idea, saying, I think it was something like, to a man at the UN, this would appear to be, like a rational act. In other words, this would seem like it was an equal tit for tat. Whereas what they were hoping to get out of it was, making it seem as though the Soviets blinked. Okay. The other question I wanted to ask you about publicity has to do with the National Enquirer. How did that relationship get started and why was it so important?
Well, I mean, the National Enquirer is the most powerful, biggest circulation paper in America, okay? It was read by the deplorables, basically. The class of deplorables, that was their reading material. That's how they learned things. And such as it was brilliantly done. And nobody of any position or any kind of substance or gravitas wanted anything to do with the National Enquirer. But Trump did. Very smartly, and he got. I mean, his friends didn't read it and hardly even knew how much he was in there. But he was in there all the time. He was one of the favorite people that was written about, and most of it was positive. But there were very negative things about his affairs and cheating, all this stuff. That was in there too, and he along with the Apprentice were the two things that brought in this vast audience. But the beginning, it was the National Enquirer. And again, an immensely shrewd thing and daring thing for him to do.
Why do you think he was daring?
because in the elite social world, you want nothing to do around a sleazy publication of that. You want nothing. You don't even have your name mentioned there to even realize you even talk to these people.
He
collaborated with them.
Oh yeah, you wrote about that. Didn't it play a role in the breakup of his first marriage?
The National Enquirer?
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, all that stuff was in there. I mean, and I kind of uncovered that. I mean, I'm surprised more wasn't made of it because I could see a very important point.
Yeah, no, why do you think that hasn't been talked about as much? Is it just because people...
You know what? Because my book was about Marlowe. My book had the wrong title on it. I want to call it The Sun King. It's really a story about Trump's life in Palm Beach, not a book about Mar-a-Lago as such. Mar-a-Lago, you know, that's what it is. So I think people they read it a different way, but these are important things that have never been written about before.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you had broken that because his relationship with the Enquirer is sort of blown up in his face.
Right.
What about... I believe I touched on this earlier, but I wanted to get it out there just because when I had heard you talk about it, it seems like a real profound insight into his character. He had given you an interesting insight into Citizen Kane, the movie, and it had something to do with the size of the table.
It's funny because it's his favorite movie. It's my favorite movie too. I've seen it many times, but I never noticed what Trump noticed, okay, which is that as the movie begins, the young Citizen Kane is sitting there having dinner at this small table with his family. As the more and more power he gets, the more wealth he has, the bigger the table gets, until at the end of the film, he's in this enormous room where he can hardly see his wife with them there at the table. It's a metaphor for the isolation of wealth. And Trump saw that right away and understood it.
Do you get any sense from your interactions with him that he, on some deep down level, is unhappy with the way his life has turned out, even if, you know, this is in superficially basically everything you could ever ask for?
Well, he's just eternally dissatisfied. Nothing is good enough. Whatever he gets is just a stopping place. He wants to go on and get, and now he's at the highest. He can't go any higher. Yeah, I think there's a level of dissatisfaction that he has, but he can't go on. He's in this manic jagged. He can't get down from that. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying for this country, the way this guy's character is at this point. And we're lucky we've gone for 3 years without some disaster. But we may have it now. You can't back down, and there's so few Republicans of integrity willing to say that what he's doing is wrong. They're just not going to do it. They don't want to lose the election.
This is kind of an obscure question, but there had been a study done at one point of powerful people. Over the course of time, and it showed that the longer people retained power, their brain started to show signs of what is basically brain damage. Their inhibition went down, their amygdala shrunk. Do you sense any change over time in Trump's personality? Do you think he's become more unhinged, let's say?
Well, I think he does, but I don't know if that analysis of power has that much to do with it. I mean, that's, look, when President Obama became president, he was such a brilliant guy. And he said how, I know when I'm president, I'm going to be limited. I'm going to become a different person, okay? I'm not going to have the openness toward things. I'm not going to see it. And that's exactly what happens. But this guy, you think about it. Has he ever talked to an average American? Ever. Ever. Okay? Wouldn't you think just shrewd politically when he's going out talking to true believers. They'd set up a time and go in and ask them what their problems are. What do they want? He's not going to do that. Him, the American people he knows and thinks about are the ones in Mar-a-Lago, okay? That's his cross-section of America. And in those rooms, there's nothing but multimillionaires in that place. Nothing but multimillionaires.
Yeah, that's it's interesting you mentioned that, because I believe during the campaign he said something like, he said this to Mark Cuban, you know, about the fact that he wasn't going to the traditional sort of small, intimate settings in Iowa, was just sticking to the rallies. And he said something like, oh, you know, Mark, well, you know, people like you and I, we don't do things like that. Like, we don't step down,
not
talk
that.
To...
Because he's not learning anything. He's not learning anything. Right. He's incapable of learning. He knows, he has these things, these ideas, that have worked with him forever. Okay, and they have worked. Like, gosh, he's president of the United States. He's not going to change those. He's got nothing else to learn.
What about... this is in the news recently. Jeffrey Epstein went to Mar-a-Lago a bunch of times. And, in fact, one of his victims was a coat check girl there. Was Epstein...
A masseuse assistant, yeah.
Sure, yes. Was Epstein a known presence around there, or was he just one of the crowd?
He was, but when Trump heard about him hitting on some young woman there, he said he shouldn't come back. So I don't fault. Some people suggest the fault was that he was involved with some of these young girls. There's no evidence of that at all.
Do you think so? Because there have been other reports saying that Trump and Epstein had a falling out over some real estate deal gone bad or something like that.
Well, that's possible too. But the more important point is he wasn't one of these guys that was with Epstein and these young girls. That I'm convinced. And another problem I write about him is in my book, and people criticize me for this, but if the guy does something positive, I'm going to put it in my book. What I just told you to me is something positive. He wasn't involved with these young girls. Now, the way journalism is written these days, you don't put that in. You only put in the negative stuff because you're pandering to your audience. Right. Don't care about the truth in any larger way. You're trying to serve your constituency and sell your book that way.
Do you think that Trump's understanding of the media has created that situation? Do you think this is something that he likes, having people having to pick sides of him or against him?
Yeah, that's what he does. We have played his game, and the New York Times, MSNBC, and CNN have played into his hands brilliantly. Okay, I mean, I'd hardly watch television anymore because it's just so edgy, and so it's not journalism anymore. People don't even know. People of a certain age, I think, don't even know what journalism is any longer. It's just endless opinion pieces, one way or the other. And Fox, of course, is even worse on the other side.
Yeah, that's what about now, though? What is his relationship to Mar-a-Lago now as president? I mean,
his relationship.
Life, yeah.
His psychological health depends on getting down there. He needs that place desperately. He needs to be somewhere where people are constantly stroking him. Same reason he goes off to give these talks all the time. He has to have that all the time. It's his drug.
There are some people who say that the lack of restrictions in terms of like access to Trump when he's down at Mar-a-Lago can be a national security risk. Do you agree with that?
At Mar-a-Lago?
Yes.
Yeah, the Secret Service was extremely worried about it. I mean, as I said, no president has ever been in a place like this. Imagine how the heck do you guard it with hundreds of people coming in there, you know? And the security has just recently almost doubled there. Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people want to kill this guy. A lot of people, I mean, it's amazing that people talk about this, okay? It's a legitimate worry. And, of course, the last thing in the world is going to happen.
Last question. How do you think this story ends for Trump, regardless of how his presidency turns out? I've heard you say that you think it's going to end in isolation for him. Well, why do you say that?
I think in the end, Mar-a-Lago ends up at what Elba was to Napoleon. It's his island. He's off by himself alone.
Wow, the comparison to the Sun King. Do you think that historically we'll remember him in similar terms? Someone who sort of rose to prominence but did maybe nasty things.
I mean, how I think it'd be seen as a horror is impact on American democracy. I mean, the true believers will never see that, but his damage this man does. We just see in this last, with the assassination. I mean, what are we doing? Where are we don't even think these things through. Just can't do that.
Well, Lawrence, on that note, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, it was fun. Okay, good luck, okay?
Alrighty, thanks so much.
Thank you to Lawrence Lemer, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.